Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han and today I'm here with my co-host Tim Hemming as well as Dr. Michaela Benson, who's a reader at Goldsmiths University of London, as well as a leading figure in research on lifestyle migration, and she's also the research leader for a project called Brexpats, Freedom of Movement, Citizenship and Brexit in the Lives of Britons Resident in the European Union. Welcome to the show, Michaela.
Thank you very much.
So you've been in France for the past month. What were you doing there?
Right, so I was in France starting the research with the project. I'd originally been in France in the early 2000s doing research with British people who'd moved to a particular part of France, to the Lot, which is a highly rural area. It's a place where there are 33 people per square kilometre, just for comparison.
You've counted each and every one.
Absolutely. And just actually for the actual comparison, this contrasts quite strongly with my research in Peckham, where there are 9,990 people per square kilometre.
Counted everyone.
Absolutely. So I had been there doing research early on in my academic career for my PhD, and for this project we decided that our starting point would be to go back to those places that we'd done research in previously. So that's me and Karen O'Reilly, who has been working with British populations on the Costa del Sol for the last 25 years, and start from there in terms of trying to understand the implications of Brexit for the lives of the people who had moved to and settled in these parts of France and Spain. So I basically spent 3 weeks visiting people, chatting with them about their lives, finding out more about their migration again, going back to people that I'd spoken to before, as well as visiting some new people, and just having a chat about how they felt about things, really. And I was actually overwhelmed. I mean, one of the things about social research is exactly to do with the fact that it can be quite difficult to recruit people. This project, that has not been the case at all. I did 23 interviews in 3 weeks, which for an academic project is almost unheard of. And I was never scrabbling around to find people. People were passing me on to people that they knew. So from that point of view, I was just very busy, and because of obviously the dispersal of the population as well, because it's not like people imagine when they think about British people who live abroad. This is not a population that lives in an enclave. They are scattered around. They live in small villages, which are mostly, you know, French people or other Europeans who might have moved and settled there. So it's quite different to what people might be thinking about when they're thinking about British people who are abroad.
By the signs of how rural it is, you did well to find 23 people in 3 weeks.
Well, I think that's what's quite interesting. The way in which that British community is networked is very interesting, and it's exactly through passing on through word of mouth that I managed to recruit that many people. I say managed to recruit. I don't feel that I was particularly active within that. And people were literally like, oh, look, I spoke to this nice young woman, and maybe you'd like to talk to her too. And that's exactly how it happened, mostly via email, which I thought was very interesting as well.
Before we dive any deeper, I just want to clear up what exactly lifestyle migration means, since you're an expert in the topic. Does that just mean moving for reasons that are not sort of forced? It's just you want to move, so you move. Is that what
it's... The reason that Karen and I came up with the idea about lifestyle migration was precisely from working with these populations in France and Spain, where the primary motivation for migration was to improve their quality of life. Now, of course, a lot of migration is exactly about that, but generally the way that migration is conceptualized is either through visa regimes, so it might be through, you know, okay, the kind of economic motivations. It might be through refugee populations and things like that, which don't really ordinarily get to the heart of the various reasons that people bring together when they're thinking about migrating. So it's never a straightforward thing. Oh, I need to go and earn money, I'll go there. You know, why would you go to somewhere like France if you needed to earn money, for example? Why would you go to somewhere like France if you were looking for a better way of life? What is that better way of life? So really drawing attention to that, those kind of more local understandings of why, you know, that people come up with for the reasons that they move.
What made you want to study this in the first place?
I had a sense that the migration literature at that time within the world of social sciences was very much skewed towards populations that were being studied because they were perceived as being a social problem. Whereas we know that Britain has a very large migration history and emigration history that was somehow being presented as something different, as not migration, whereas actually, you know, British people have been moving all over the world through colonialism and through other things historically for long periods of time. They are, because of the fact of being British, relatively privileged, and I say relatively privileged, compared with other populations. The ease with which British people have always crossed borders is remarkable, really, in the grander scheme of things. But that doesn't mean that those people who are moving are always particularly rich, particularly wealthy. There's diversity within that population, which we really need to pay attention to, particularly at the moment, I think, in a situation where some of the things that have supported British migration to other parts of Europe are going to be removed, and we'll see how that plays out for different populations and people in different circumstances.
I think there's a general lack of understanding, this idea that not all migration is the same. Brits moving abroad is not the same as immigrants coming to this country, and that's how the public perceive it.
Well, I think that it's understandable why people might think like that. People don't necessarily think about those populations as migrants. And until now, I think it would be fair to say that in a lot of cases, people wouldn't even refer to themselves as migrants. In fact, the intra-European migration, the freedom of movement within Europe, because it's elevated onto a different scale to the, you know, it's taken out of the migration governance in this country. It isn't governed in the same way. So we don't,
you have freedom of movement.
So that in part, I think, helps to obscure the similarities actually between the movements of people across borders. And that's not to say that, you know, that British people moving abroad are the same as refugee populations or anything like that. There are very different issues that come up around those different things. But at the same time, I think that there is something to be gained, and I've argued this very, very strongly over the last 10 years, from referring to those populations as migrants and to seeing, you know, to say, right, okay, this is a migration. These are the things that structure that migration, that allow it, that make it possible. These are the lives that people are leading there. And in some ways, you know, this is how governments, for example, have encouraged these populations to move, much as the British government has encouraged populations to come to the UK and work, or come to the UK and buy property, if we want to think about the more elite forms of migration that we have in this country that also don't get included in that discussion of who is a migrant. So I think that's where I see it useful as thinking about British people abroad as migrant populations.
And then, of course, there's the issue of thinking about who these actual migrants are, because in the wake of the referendum, it's sort of always been, you know, pensioners who are worried about the money that they're going to get in retirement when they're abroad. But obviously, I'm sure, as you found, and as you probably already knew, it's much more diverse than that.
Yeah, it's really diverse. And I think that this is the important thing. To point out, the British press historically and actually, you know, in the popular imagination, there are kind of almost two types of British people who live abroad. So there are the British pensioners who are vulnerable, living in these parts of Europe that are cheaper to live in. That's a very prominent representation. And in the wake of the referendum, we saw quite a lot of scapegoating of that population as well, from the point of view of trying to point out, suggest, oh, well, you know, these people, they don't, you know, people were flooding to journalists, particularly flooding to Spain, it seemed, and going and talking to that population. And on one hand, they might be vulnerable. On the other hand, they might be the people who didn't have the self-awareness to vote to remain. Even though exactly those things. So there were some strange things going on around that.
You think that was incorrectly reported?
It's not that I think that was incorrectly reported. What I think is that it would be unsurprising to me to find that there were British people in Europe who voted to leave. And I think that to understand why they might have done that would require going back and asking questions about the narratives that they, you know, how they were supporting their migration and what they understood Europe was doing for them in various ways. So I think that that's the kind of the context which would be required to explain that. And at the same time, there's another representation, which is of the kind of, as it comes up frequently when I'm talking to people in France as well, the kind of the wine-swilling, gin and tonic-drinking old colonials, basically. That's another representation that we get. Now, you know, these obviously do some work. They obviously do something to give people a sense of some of the populations that are abroad. But I think we also have to remember that there are a large number of British people who work in Europe, who've moved to Europe precisely for their jobs, been taken there for work. There are also a lot of people who are in dual national couples or families, and that, I think, is a really interesting an interesting case. There are also second-generation British people living there, so people whose parents might have moved out of there and who may never have lived in Britain, but are not nationals in the country that they live in, and yet probably have had most of their education in the country and probably more closely associate with the country that they've been brought up in than they do with Britain, where they may never have lived. And then, of course, there are students as well. There are British students all over Europe. So it is a very diverse population, and people are in a range of different circumstances. So if you consider that on the one hand, okay, there's been this big focus on pensioners, pensioners who might have moved when they retired. This is a very, you know, Britain is not the only country where we have this type of migration flow out. You know, a lot of the Scandinavian countries have got rather large populations who spend parts of the year or most of the year down on the southern European coast, Germany too. So it's not idiosyncratic from that point of view. So people who've paid their taxes, who've paid their national insurance in the UK all of their lives, and who may in some cases be receiving their income from the UK, so their pensions from the UK. So there are those people. But there are also people who may never have done that precisely because they've lived and worked elsewhere in Europe for the whole of their lives. And so the stakes of Brexit for those different populations are quite different. If you start to unpack it. And the more and more I speak to people, both in France but also across Europe, it's just the stakes seem to be multiplying. It just depends, you know, depends on your personal circumstance, on the kind of the situation of your household. You know, if you're in a dual national couple, what about women, for example, who might be doing childcare for their partners who are working? If they become third country nationals, now this is a term that I'm not sure people are very knowledgeable about, but this is how the migration governance works. If you become a third country national in the UK, if you're trying to come in, you're subject to minimum income thresholds, language, ability, knowledge of life in the UK, all of these types of things. And most European countries have an equivalent. So what happens in the case of those women, perhaps? For example, they're not the only potential thing that we need to focus on. When, you know, maybe they're at home looking after their kids, they don't meet a minimum income threshold for the household. What's going to happen then? And I think that those are questions that we really need to think about. Think about where those precarious populations might be. And some elderly pensioners might be part of that story, but they're definitely not the whole part of the story.
So just to be clear on what the definition of a third country national.
Yeah.
Once we move out of the European Union,
yeah,
then any Brits abroad will be termed as...
Potentially. I mean, this is what we don't know at the moment. We actually don't know any of these, what's going to happen. But if that were to happen, if all of a sudden European Union nationals in the UK and British nationals living elsewhere in the EU27 were to find themselves subject to migration regimes, they would be third country nationals. So they would be subject to the same rules and regulations as other immigrant populations being brought, you know, coming into countries.
And do you think Theresa May's settled status proposal goes some way to addressing that?
Well, in the case of this is not about British people in Europe. That is solely about EU nationals in the UK.
But that proposal is sort of under the assumption that it would then be matched from the EU, right?
But how could you match a proposal like that from the European Union when you have 27 different member states which have their own different migration regulations? That is not when you get into third country national status, you're talking about individual nation states and their migration regimes. So there could be really different rules depending on which country you live in. And there's another situation that we also know about, where in some places we have people who are cross-border workers. So they might live in France and work in Belgium. And so they've been able to do that precisely because they can cross the border with no challenge on a daily basis. Mm. They're going to also find themselves in potentially in a difficult situation.
So what you're saying, sorry, Jen, so what you're saying is, in terms of whatever offer is really agreed over here for EU nationals living in Britain, it's going to be really difficult to have that reciprocated across on the continent because there's so many states anyway.
Well, I think that it depends on what level that's taken. So at the moment, what we don't know is whether anything around citizens' rights is going to be agreed and whether they'll reach an agreement. They know very, very clearly that what the EU's offered at the moment is not the same as what the British government has offered. I think that we know that that's true. And of course, today at 2 o'clock, they're going to make some kind of announcement. And I'm just waiting to see what happens. But if they don't reach an agreement on citizens' rights, then we might find ourselves defaulting to this position where British people in other European Union countries are going to find themselves subject to the migration regimes of those individual countries. And up until now, British people have never had to worry about that in those countries. And I think it's quite telling, being in France, people are actually taking matters into their own hands. And they're thinking, right, what can I do to make sure that I can stay here? That's the kind of bottom line. How can I ensure that I can stay here? And they're starting to apply for French citizenship. And we know that the French citizenship applications from British nationals have soared. It's gone up by something like 254% for last year. Now, actually, the absolute numbers, that's only at 1,300 and something people starting to register that. I suspect that the figures for 2017 will be higher again. And it would be interesting to see the success of those British people going through a citizenship test, essentially.
Is it a question you pose to your 23 interview subjects?
About whether they're taking
French citizenship? Yes.
I didn't pose the question about whether they're taking it. They told me that they were taking it.
And how many of those 23 suggested that they were going to apply?
So those were 23 interviews, so they're probably with about 60 people in total, just as a thing. And I was surprised by the high number of people in their late 60s and above who were already trying to take French citizenship. So I think within those interviews, there were at least probably 5 or 6 of those interviews were about people who were going to work with people who were trying to apply for French citizenship at that point. And then there were the people who were going to wait and see what happened, but would consider taking French citizenship if that was what they needed to do in order to say, applying for, say, taking. It's not as straightforward as just going in and saying, I would like to be a French national. Now, in the case of France and Britain, that seems to be okay because dual nationality has been permitted. It's not the case with all other countries. And in some cases, as we've already heard about Germany and the Netherlands, I believe, there's a situation where they allow dual nationality with other EU member states. But with the removal of Britain from the European Union, it might be that they have to surrender one or other of their nationalities. So that changes things quite significantly. Because for the people because people are attached to being British as well. It's not just a case of, I'm going to become French and I'm going to sever my ties with Britain, for example. It's a much more complicated picture than that.
What did you get the sense of the prevailing attitude from people that you interviewed? The one thing that keeps coming through the way you're talking today is the amount of uncertainty.
Yeah.
Which probably leads to being unsettled and some quite fearful of what may come next. Did you find any optimism at all?
So, I think it's fair to say that the prevailing attitude, I wouldn't say prevailing. There were a whole range of emotions there. So there were people who were very angry, and you could feel it in the room when we were talking. People's faces would go red, they would start to raise their voices. Soon, they'd be talking about living in France, which, it's a nice, for many people, is a nice topic of conversation. And then they would get onto Brexit and the whole atmosphere in the room would change. get very angry, very frustrated, reporting feeling betrayed, feeling alienated, all of this type of thing. Unanimously, people agreed that the European Union needed reform. So I think that's an important thing to say. But yes, there were some people who were optimistic, who thought that this was absolutely the right thing for Britain to do. They were in a minority, but they existed.
And what were their plans going to be for themselves?
So that varied. So, you know, in one case, it was somebody that I've known for a long time, for about 15 years. And she said, well, if the French don't want us here after all of this, I'll just go back. And she was quite adamant that she would do that. In another case, he was going to take French citizenship. And he told me very, very clearly that if France ever voted, he would also vote that France leave the European Union. It was a very coherent narrative about why Britain should leave the European Union, you know. So they do, you know.
His views really that states should be individual and there should be no cartels across the world. There should be sovereignty throughout the world, really.
He believed in sovereignty. He said he'd been in favour of Europe when it was about a trade bloc, but didn't believe in this kind of supranational governance. So, you know, from that point of view, he was quite optimistic about the future. You know, it's there are a variety, and I'd gone expecting a variety of responses. Mm. And obviously the flavour of the project could also have put some people off coming forwards to take part who might have thought that actually Brexit wasn't really a big issue. I think that there is a huge amount of uncertainty. There's a huge amount of politicisation as a consequence, in a way that I had not... Well, I probably anticipated a little bit, but the extent of it I hadn't. I mean, you must have seen there's a whole host of campaigns that are organised around British communities who live in Europe, which is a relatively new thing. I mean, there were always, you know, small groups in places, but never this kind of coordinated action. And those are campaigns around citizens, European citizens' rights. They're campaigns that are specifically about British people. They're campaigns around Remain. I haven't found any campaigns around British people in Europe and Leave, but you probably wouldn't expect that to be the case. And it's also clear that party membership for some political parties is probably on the rise because of the consequence of their British populations abroad, which I think is also very interesting. Mm. The overseas votes become an issue all over again, and now, of course, it looks as though it's been dropped from the manifesto, so there is a great deal of upset about that. So there was upset around the fact that for a lot of these people who've been living outside of Britain for over 15 years, that they did not have the right to vote in this crucial referendum that they felt probably was the one thing that had happened in their lives since they moved there that actually was likely to have the most significant impact on their lives. So,
what was the most shocking thing you heard from anyone?
Oh goodness, the most shocking thing I heard from anyone.
Or surprising, doesn't need to be a bad kind of shocking, yeah. It could be a positive thing. Unexpected, anything out of the ordinary, I suppose.
It's really difficult to say. To kind of put it into context, this, you know, I've worked on with populations like British people in France for 15 years, so it's not that things were shocking or surprising. I think that the speed with which the diversity of experience became apparent was quite interesting, and people are in very different financial circumstances. The lives that they might have imagined living when they were there have been not necessarily thrown into sharp relief by Brexit, but it's an additional thing that has actually impacted on how they imagine their futures. And all, as it was always the way, I think what's interesting, that's probably a kind of a take-home thing to remember, is it's very seldom that people are kind of individual migrants, like one person. They're in households, and their migration is often about moving somewhere with their partner, with their family, with all of those, you know, those other relationships around it. And that when those things change, so for example, I came across a few women who had been widowed since they moved to France, in some cases quite suddenly as well, where their lives had been reliant on, you know, having a dual income from, you know, their pensions or what have you, and had found themselves having to go back to work at the age of 60, you know, in France, trying to find ways of making ends meet. And there are people out there who are struggling to make ends meet because of circumstances that happened to them that they couldn't possibly have anticipated in that way. You know, you'd never want to imagine your partner dying. So, and then the additional uncertainty of Brexit on top of that, really, the idea that they might have to move back to the UK, where, you know, they're struggling to afford to live in one of the cheapest parts of France, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And the idea that they would come back to the UK and have to, you know, start that all over again is terrifying, actually, I think, is probably the best way.
Yeah, so to restart life again. And,
yeah.
When you know, most people looking towards their pensions.
When they're settled as well. Yeah. You know, when they're settled, when they've made lives for themselves in these places. And I think that that's worth thinking about. And I think that it's those populations who are, you know, somehow more vulnerable, more precarious for whatever reason, that we need to pay particular attention to. Because the people who have the right amount, you know, the right capitals, so the right amount of money, the right language capabilities, who, you know, have, you know, probably assets back in the UK, all of those, most likely they will be okay, I imagine, whatever their decision is. But there are going to be people for whom this is not going to be okay.
I know you focused on France, and that's where you spent your time. Do you have a sense of around the states of the EU, with British nationals living over there, which countries are going to be most charitable, is probably the wrong word, but which are most embracing to them as we head towards Brexit? Are there ones that should worry more than others? Is it not a clear picture?
Without having done a systematic review of the different regimes, the different migration regimes, and the different, you know, even things as simple as, this doesn't even go down to migration regimes, but how you get registered for social security in particular countries or registered to be able to work, I wouldn't really be able to say. I think that that's something to pay attention to, you know, going forwards. The project only started on the 1st of June. So
give you time.
So we need a little bit of time to do that. But, you know, there are a whole host of other things. It's not just about freedom of movement and the reciprocal arrangements relating to healthcare and relating to pensions and things like that. There are other issues. The one big issue that's kind of come up is the ability of people to work in other European Union member states relies on a recognition of qualifications, and that's something that comes with the European Union. If that gets taken away, it's something like, somebody was telling me, so there's a register within Europe of people with professional qualifications, where, you know, the translation of, you know, British degree
to
like a teaching qualification or something equivalent, or a law or doctor. Now, if they can't reach an agreement about that, that means that a lot of British people and EU nationals living in the UK who currently have their qualifications recognised and so can work here because of that will cease to have their qualifications recognised. And that is going to be quite detrimental to various professions. Teaching is quite a significant one. Most of the people who are recognised as having professional qualifications for teaching within the European Union, kind of workers, 60% of them are British. So I think that that's something to pay attention to.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you start to go into this, it's not just about freedom of movement, it's about all of those other things that support people's ability to live and work.
That's quite interesting for me as well, because I'm from Germany, but I did my bachelor's degree here. So is there a chance that I might not be able to work with my degree if I ever were to go back home?
My understanding is that this is specifically about professional qualifications. So things where you'd have to have, like, you know, if you're a doctor, you have to have
teaching,
a particular
doctor,
type
law,
of degree,
that kind of,
you know,
yeah.
That type of thing. But, I mean, we also have had reported anecdotally that, you know, places are stopping, are not appointing, you know, people with, well, British people. We've heard that, just as we've heard that there are places in the UK that are saying, okay, we won't take any EU nationals to work for us now. So, you know, actually, irrespective of what the changes are, the effects are already beginning because people, you know, within the labour market are actually trying to anticipate what could happen.
Yes. Yeah.
And that, I think, is also, you know, irrespective of the policies, I think we have to be attentive also to the way in which these kind of public bodies and industries and private enterprises are actually responding to something that hasn't happened yet. And now, I think that's quite interesting.
Sorry, Jen, go.
I saw on your website that you're also wanting to look into how something like migration, but then also specifically Brexit, can influence people's sense of identity. And I find that really interesting because I don't think there's always a recognition about how something that seems such a big issue that's so far removed technically from people's lives because it is so all-encompassing can influence something as small and as intimate as someone's identity. So how do you see that dynamic working?
So I think that one of the big themes within social science work on migration is always about identity, home and belonging. They're kind of like three tripartite connected things. And I think in this case, what became very clear to me when I was in France was about British identities and European identities and how they interplay with one another. So we know that, I mean, I suspect that this has been contested at various points, but British people have had the lowest level of attachment to Europe as a population. So the kind of statistical data demonstrates this. We also know from having worked with British populations in Europe that Europeanness was something that people were always quite ambivalent about. It wasn't necessarily something that they would cling on to and say, oh, I'm a European, you know.
These are French people, German people, Dutch people. They would see themselves their own nationality. They don't necessarily see themselves.
Yeah, I mean that's the, you know, the kind of thing. And it's not to say that you're either a national or a European either. But when you talk to people, you get a sense of, you know, how they associate,
yeah, national pride,
and what it means to them. Going back to France after 12 years away, and talking to people, what became very, very clear was the extent to which what people thought being British meant was they'd also become quite ambivalent about. Because of the, especially among the people who are very disappointed and very upset about the outcome, you know, their descriptions of what being British is now are very much framed around isolationism, very much framed around a lack of openness, a lack of tolerance. You know, discourses that I'm sure, you know, working in the media, you're very familiar with. And often being European, you know, then perhaps became the way of talking about how they thought Britishness should have been or how they had associated it more historically. So it is at the moment, the identity focus is to do with the kind of national identities, European identities, thinking about what those mean and how people use them in the way that they talk.
And a deeper question, but because it is your background, why do we focus so much on identity anyway? Why is it important?
So I don't think that we can really understand what people are doing in somewhere like, you know, what these migrations without talking about identity. This is my way into it, has always been to think about how people identify, but also what particular things mean to them. I think it's, you know, what does it mean to move to somewhere like France, or specifically rural France? What does that tell us about who those people are, and what their dreams and aspirations are, what their experiences are, what their biographies are? So I kind of try and always look at it, you know, my approach to understanding the lives of the people that I've worked with has always been to ask them, well, you know, what brought you here? And to start from there and to find out all of the events in their life that might have led up to this. You know, it's perhaps unsurprising to find that there are British people who live in France, who've lived in various other parts of the world before they've chosen to settle in France. And it is, you know, it's the human side of things that goes beyond the statistics. And people are very complicated. And it's very, very clear that when you try and sit down and, you know, write all of this out, or I try and talk to you about it, that actually it's very difficult to communicate the complexity of people's lives and decisions and identities. you know, they seem to be, you know, contradictory things at times, being British, being European. And at other times they seem to be conflated. And then you ask them, what does it mean to become French citizen? Well, the question is, are they becoming French? I mean, this is a, you know, these are kind of, I think they're questions that we, you know, should be asking. Because actually, what I feel about particularly those British people that I've been working with is actually that becoming French for them is about being able to stay in a very localized place, being able to stay in this place that they've made their home, where, you know, where they've set up their lives. And that's what it's about. It's being able to keep what they've got and not lose what they've got.
That is their France.
That's their France, yeah.
So thanks ever so much for joining us today. Now, you said the project started in the start of June. So where are you heading with it now?
So at the moment, what we're doing is I have to go back to all of those interviews. I've been listening back to them. I've been having them transcribed, and I'll be working with them over the next few months. I'll be going back to France. Karen O'Reilly will be going to Spain in October. We also have a researcher who's going to be working with us. And she starts at the beginning of September, and she's going to start to pull together a group, hopefully of 100 people, who are British people who live all the way across Europe. And we're going to be doing work with them on a regular basis, via the internet, doing, you know, brief chats with them over Skype, talking to them about particular points as they arise in the Brexit negotiations, and just getting a sense of how they're managing that. And of course, you know, the tricky thing about having just been to France is that I've just got a flavour of what it's like right now, and we know that this is going to go on for a long time. So how people respond and react to it, and what it, you know, what it means for their lives, will unfold over that period of time. So, I mean, at the moment, the people who are saying, well, you know, we might have to go back, because of course there are people who are saying that, who are trying to make a decision about whether now is the right time to sell their house because they need to be able to afford something back in the UK, or whether they should wait for 6 months. So it will be interesting to see how people adjust over that period of time. I think, you know, to go back to an earlier question that you asked me, what was the most shocking thing? The people who are actually physically ill as a consequence of this, or, as you know, or their physical symptoms have been exacerbated by this. Mm-hmm. I think that this is, I mean, for the people who are undergoing healthcare for long-term illnesses, you know, chronic illnesses, in some cases perhaps terminal illnesses, this uncertainty about what's going to happen to their reciprocal arrangements about healthcare, which is another area that's completely misunderstood and has always been misunderstood by the general public, is very worrying. People who are on medication.
You say it's been misunderstood. You probably have to explain that just
briefly for us. So I think that people, well, I think it's often misunderstood. If you move to another European Union country at the moment, you are entitled to the access to healthcare of the people who live in that country. So we have an NHS here. So European Union nationals, provided they meet particular kind of criteria, can come and use the national healthcare system. And then in theory, that is subsidised by their country of origin. Okay, so that's how it's supposed to work. Now, of course, not every single welfare state in the European Union operates in the same way in relation to health. So, for example, in France, people have, it's actually a very complicated system that's quite difficult to explain, but a certain proportion is paid for, and then the rest has to be either paid for out of your own pocket, through insurance, through, if you're in employment, it might be that there's a contribution from there, you know, all of those kinds of things. In a situation, if you can imagine a situation where you might be on, you know, long-term medication that's probably costing thousands and thousands of euros, the prospect even of a blip of a couple of weeks where you don't know what's going to happen is terrifying. And I did come across that a couple of times.
Because you don't know how your medication, which is very expensive, is going to get paid for in that period.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, you know, these are people who have been doing things legally. They've been, you know, paying their taxes and, you know, paying their taxes through work in France, or paying their taxes back in the UK through their pensions. And they don't. There is so that, you know, those people are in a very vulnerable position anyway, and the fear that comes with that has become too much for some people. Mm.
And has a detrimental effect on their physical
health.
Yeah,
has a you know. So I think that that's worth drawing attention to, and that's not just old people. There are young people who are also ill in those, you know. As you might imagine, I mean, it's a broad population, and I think that, you know, when we're talking through these issues around citizens' rights, when we're talking through those things, I think we have to remember that human face as well. You know, I think that's it's really important, and that we remember that the fallout is not going to be even; it will be uneven because the population is in a, you know, this British population that lives in Europe are in a whole range of different circumstances. So I think that's an important point to kind of take home.
It's probably a good point to leave it.
Actually, before we let you go, I just want to touch
one more
on the way that you're wanting to communicate your results for a second, because from what I've been able to tell, obviously you're doing it through a podcast and then also through a newsletter, I think. And I think that's really interesting because obviously usually you'd sort of results of ethnographic research would sort of get put in an academic research paper and in a journal, and then the only people that would ever see it would be academics. Is that a conscious decision of you wanting the general population to be aware of the results?
So it's a range of different things. Actually, academic research now has to communicate more publicly, and this particular scheme, the project's in a scheme run by the UK and Changing Europe, the particular scheme was built around the constant public engagement of the researchers who are involved in the different projects. So when we designed the project, we designed it to have a very ongoing public communication plan. So we have the podcasts. They're not just about the findings of the research. They're actually bringing in other people. So for example, this afternoon I'll be talking to a couple of people about the legal position of British people in the European Union historically and what might happen. Because that's expertise that, you know, I'm aware of what it is, but it's not actually my area of expertise because I'm a sociologist. So we're kind of bringing in those types of things. The newsletter is mostly to try and communicate with people who've taken part in the research as well, so that they feel that they've got an ongoing engagement in the project. We have our Twitter feed and our Facebook page as well, and our website. And there will be other things as well that are coming out. We're going to do a series of key trend reports, which probably the first one will come out around the autumn time. And in time, we will still do the academic papers, but they're probably, I don't think they're the least interesting thing, but they're the thing that take a really long period of time to prepare. And because of the urgency of this topic, I think it's really important that we get information about the project out there and about issues that concern people. So one of the other things that I've been doing through the Facebook page, particularly when I was in France, was, you know, you come across people and they talk to you about not understanding how to get permanent residency or to get a residency permit, which is something that European Union nationals were eligible to do, but were not required to do. But some people wanted to do that as a way of, you know, giving them a little bit of security while this process is ongoing. And so it's just a simple thing, like just putting the webpage up for people to go to. Because I think that it's very, very easy for us to think that everyone knows how to navigate the internet as well as we do. Whereas for me, it's like a, you know, 2-minute search on the French government website. For them, it might not even occur to them to go to the French government website. So it's just those types of, you know, just pointing people in the right direction, I think.
So in terms of pointing people in the right direction,
yeah,
where should people go now for more information?
So I think that the best thing to do is to go to our webpage, where almost all of the information about everything we do is. And that's www.brexitbritsabroad.com. We also have a very lively Twitter feed, which is BrexPatsEU. So that's something that people can go and check out. But yeah, that's where I would direct people to. And all the links to the podcast are on the webpage, all the links to our social media on the webpage. Information about me and Karen, that's all there as well if anyone's interested. And actually there's also a reading list of articles on British migration to Europe, if, you know, for people who want to get stuck in and really, you know,
really roll up their sleeves and find out all about it.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please feel free to subscribe to us and follow us on the usual social networks at Brexit Podcast and at brexitpodcast.com to stay up to date on all the best Brexit news and opinions. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Paul, and our theme song is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod.